Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. As part of his tour of West Africa, UN Chief Antonio Guterres has visited Niger, where he said on Tuesday that the country needs the full support of the international community to keep terrorist groups at bay. The UN Secretary General was speaking in Oualem in western Niger, where he expressed his solidarity with communities targeted by deadly attacks in January that left at least 100 dead and displaced many more. But it's not just military and financial assistance that Niger needs, Mr. Guterres said, as he highlighted the climate shocks and drought that have created dire humanitarian needs in the country. The best way to fight terrorism is to give people hope, the UN chief continued, to show them that they have a future where people can have access to schools, hospitals and work. In Ukraine, UN humanitarians have begun to help the first evacuees arriving from Mariupol's heavily damaged Azovstal steelworks, more than 2 months since Russia's invasion began. Early reports indicate that the evacuees started to arrive later than expected on Tuesday at a reception centre in Zaporizhia, more than 200 miles north of Mariupol. It comes after more than 100 civilians were allowed to leave the steelworks complex at the weekend. From the UN World Health Organization, or WHO, Dr. Dorit Nizan, incident manager for Ukraine, reported that many other civilians from towns and villages on the outskirts of western Mariupol had already arrived at Zaporizhia reception center.
We have all been already receiving people, and mainly mothers and children, from Mariupol and its vicinity. So these people continue coming. And I don't know if you can see in the background, but cars are coming with volunteers from the region here, Zaporizhia, that are driving them from the contact line.
Before the Russian invasion on the 24th of February, Mariupol's population numbered around 500,000. Today, around 100,000 are believed to remain in the battered city, the WHO official said. For this year's World Press Freedom Day, on Tuesday, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has paid tribute to courageous journalists who continue to risk their lives for their work. Many reporters have little choice but to work amidst ever-increasing harassment, intimidation, surveillance and risk to their lives and livelihoods, Ms. Bachelet insisted at a ceremony in Geneva.
They do so for the sake of all of us, so that we have access to free, accurate and independent information, so that we can live in just and peaceful societies. The work helps build a foundation for some of the fundamental human rights we should all enjoy: freedom of opinion, information and expression.
It is crucial that journalists continue to expose atrocities, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights noted. Her comments following her condemnation of deadly communal violence in Sudan's Darfur and reported summary executions of civilians in Bucha in Ukraine. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Yanis Varoufakis.
The war in Ukraine must end today. It must end because Ukrainians are dying and because more war is not the answer to war. And it must end because the poor, not just, of course, in Europe and North America, inflation when it comes to food prices in Africa, in Asia, in India, destroying the lives of countless millions of people. We have a moral duty to end this war.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Heat from the future just struck Pakistan and India. Almost a billion humans on the planet went through days above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 degrees C. It's not much cooler at night. There is little air conditioning. As Megan Darby writes in Climate Home News, crops are withering. People too, but the extent of excess mortality will be modeled after the fact, not written on death certificates, end quote. As 350.org's Bill McKibben tweeted, 10% of all the people on Earth are sweltering under truly extreme heat tonight. On April 26th, Dr. Elizabeth Sawin tweeted, the heat also threatens wheat harvest at a time when global supplies of the crop are already under pressure due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Heat waves have hit India's biggest wheat-producing states, Haryana, Uttar Pradesh, and Punjab. She links to a revealing article about the India heat and world food supplies in that reliable publication, New Scientist. It has this headline, Severe Indian Heat Wave Will Bake a Billion People and Damage Crop. Yes, it gets hot all through India and Pakistan, but not this hot in April. It's like summer in the spring. Temperatures went over 45 degrees Celsius, that's 113 Fahrenheit, in many cities of India. There was an underreported scorching April heat wave in South America, too. Far away from global newsrooms of the West, other people are stressed, suffering, and dying because a few countries built empires built on fossil fuels. That is the ugly truth. A few play, the many pay. We must stop dumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Can forests help us? Can we save the very birthing ground of species in the tropical forests? We will talk with the Director General of CIFOR, the largest forest science organization in the world. Famed scientist Dr. Robert Nasi has a warning, though. Other life does not care if humans fail and go extinct. Earth is not a benign playground, all made for us, he says. But first, yet another alert from science. In most parts of the world, the probability of tropical cyclone strikes will double, and not by 2100, but 2050. That's during the next few decades. In some places, the risk of hurricanes, typhoons, or cyclones, call them what you will, returning is four times greater or even more. Get ready for a stormy world. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith.
Oh, heavenly grid, help us bear up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the gulf of compromise, standing humble on the rich field of mobile American thinking. Here in this shell, we call life.
That's a classic from the Fire Sign Theater.
It seems the world is being hit with more big storms. But is that really true? Call them hurricanes, typhoons, or tropical cyclones. Will they get worse in coming decades as the world warms? The answer has been unknown and maybe unknowable with the current records we have and the tools we have, unless someone finds the patterns to how tropical cyclones work. That is the thesis and new paper from Nadia Bloemendaal at Free University Amsterdam. Nadia has won several awards for her work on risks even before completing her doctorate, including one from the big insurer Lloyds from the Netherlands. Nadia Bloemendaal, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
When planning risk and climate policy, world governments depend on the latest global climate models. Why do those models leave us blind to developing cyclone risks?
Well, in order to properly understand tropical cyclone risk, we want to understand the full spectrum of all tropical cyclones that could potentially hit your location of interest. So that's not just the weaker storms, but we're also talking about the unprecedented, never seen before events that could inflict a lot of damage and a lot of impact. But the problem with climate models and the problem with historical records is that they are typically too short of a temporal length. They're typically covering 30 to maybe 100 years, if you're lucky. They're covering 30 to 100 years, which is just too short to understand all the possible tropical cyclones that could hit Miami or that could hit Houston.
So you developed a new algorithm called STORM. What does that allow scientists and really any analyst who can get the data to do?
As I said, the historical records, they have too short of a temporal scale. But with STORM, we can actually overcome this problem. So what STORM does is it takes the tropical cyclone statistics that we see in the historical records or in the climate models. So think about frequency, intensity, tracks. We take all that information out of those data sets and we plug them into our statistical model. And our statistical model then creates a new tropical cyclone out of that information. And that tropical cyclone is then theoretically possible under those climate conditions from which you took the data out. Now, that procedure of creating a new tropical cyclone is something that you can repeat for thousands and thousands of times. So that means that you can basically blow up the records that you had with new statistically likely possible tropical cyclones. And that way, we can finally start to analyze and start to simulate those intense tropical cyclones that inflict a lot of damage in any place on Earth. And that's why that's really relevant for risk assessments.
Nadia, you led the new paper titled A Globally Consistent Local Scale Assessment of Future Tropical Cyclone Risk. Why is local scale an essential component of the storms that you study?
Well, the simple answer here is that tropical cyclone risk is highly spatially varying. It's really depending on which location you look at, what that risk profile looks like. So, for instance, if we're looking at the Caribbean, Puerto Rico has a way higher chance of being hit by an intense tropical cyclone than, for instance, Grenada or Bonaire. So you cannot really squeeze them together in your same analysis. They are highly different in their risk profile. And that's why this local scale is so important.
Well, obviously, we cannot measure the future. We can only model it. Did you employ historical wind data as well as sort of a cross-check to your system?
So in a study that we published in 2020, we actually created a present climate, well, 1980 to 2017 climate conditions. We created such a data set with storm. So we used historical observations and then plugged that into storm to create this new synthetic data set. And that was a data set that we could validate against the historical statistics. Now, the thing that I need to clarify here is that synthetic models create new tropical cyclones that are theoretically possible. So you cannot one-on-one compare those synthetic tracks. You will not find Hurricane Katrina in there, but you might find a Hurricane Katrina-like cyclone, just to clarify how the models work. So in order to validate, as you were asking, what you can do is you can validate the statistics. So does your model not overestimate intensity? Is it all, you know, within reasonable bounds of what we saw in historical data? And STORM is doing a pretty good job on that aspect.
Well, I think it's really too bad the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change rearranged all the names for the climate future scenarios. We were just getting to learn the older ones, and now hardly anyone knows what the new ones mean. Your group used the SSP5-85 scenario as our assumed climate future. Could you tell us what that means and how does it compare with the reality of our current emissions?
So SSP 585 compares best to what was previously known as RCP 8.5. And RCP 8.5 is a climate scenario in which we assume that basically no changes are being done to our emission scenario. So we continue emitting, high amounts of CO2 and other greenhouse gases every year. To translate that to what does that look like in, for instance, 2100, SSP 585 around 3.3 to 5.7 degrees of global warming by 2100. Now, there's one thing that I need to mention here, and that is that we are not looking at the far future. We are looking at the near future. So that is between 2015 and 2050. And actually what we know also from the IPCC reports is that in that shorter time span, so in that near future window, the SSP scenarios, the RCP scenarios, they don't really differ that much in their temperature projections. The temperatures really start to ramp up after 2050. So that SSP 585 scenario, you could say in a way that it is what's somehow going to happen over the next few decades, irrespective of which emission scenario you take.
That makes a lot of sense. So your team finds the probability of intense tropical cyclones on average more than doubles in all regions except for the Bay of Bengal and the Gulf of Mexico. Let's take that last part first. It's great news that the storm-battered Gulf of Mexico and the Bay of Bengal, which has been hit so many times, will not double in the probability of tropical cyclones or hurricanes according to your study. Why are those already stormy places not expected to get worse along with the rest of the world?
Okay, let's discuss these one by one. So in the case of the Bay of Bengal, We found that the climate models that we used as input data for STORM, that they were actually projecting that the genesis region, so where the tropical cyclone forms, moves closer to the land in the near future climate. It moves closer to the Indian Sri Lanka land mass. And with moving closer to land and the cyclone forming there, there's actually less time for a tropical cyclone to intensify all the way up to category 4 or 5 before it makes landfall. Because as soon as it makes landfall, it starts to decay because it loses its connection with the warm ocean waters. So that is what's happening in the Bay of Bengal. They're moving closer to the shore, and then they have less time to intensify all the way up to those higher intensities. And these results were actually, yeah, in a slightly different way, but they are backed up by other literature. So it's not just an artifact from our models. And in the case of the Gulf of Mexico, there's actually something really interesting going on there. What we found was that in the Gulf of Mexico, the absolute number of all tropical cyclone formations is actually about projected to decrease. So we're going to see less tropical cyclones overall in the Gulf of Mexico. The reason that is, well, one of the reasons is because of enhanced atmospheric stability. So with a more stable atmosphere, a tropical cyclone will have a harder time to form. But the problem is, as soon as the cyclone does manage to form, the seawaters, the warmer seawaters, are actually serving as extra fuel for that system to get going. So once the cyclone does manage to form, chances are higher that it's going to be a more intense cyclone. And rather coincidentally, I don't have an exact explanation for this, but rather coincidentally, the amount of intense tropical cyclones that forms in the future climate is then still approximately the same as in the present climate, even though the conditions are less favorable. So, and that has its effect on, yeah, on our estimates, that nothing much is changing.
So it won't be as scary as it could be at the Gulf of Mexico, but I don't want to gloss over the first part of that sentence, namely that tropical cyclones on average, the probability more than doubles wherever tropical cyclones are normally found. So that sounds pretty serious for us all.
Yeah, so, well, we do have to say here that we are talking on the effects on the local scale. So it's not that everything basin-wide is going to double, but when you look at it in your town or in your city, yeah, in any region other than the Gulf of Mexico or the Bay of Bengal, yeah, that probability of facing an intense cyclone condition on average more than doubles. Yeah, that's our finding, yeah.
So we know the global average, as you've said, they matter less than what really happens locally. Where does your study suggest the biggest increases in tropical cyclones will strike?
So what we found was that predominantly in, yeah, the Western Pacific region, such as Japan and South Korea, and in the South Pacific near Australia and, well, the South Pacific Islands, that the largest increases are projected to occur there. And we're talking about a 5- to 10-fold increase in tropical cyclone, yeah, wind speed probabilities. And it even goes up to a factor 21 near Japan. So that's significant.
A couple of decades ago, scientist Kerry Emanuel suggested America would be hit by more hurricanes as the world warmed, like the number would go up. And then came a surprise, the number of hurricanes did not increase in that period, but the intensity of superstorms did. Where does your study come in on this question? We know storms will have more energy, but will we have more of them?
What we found was that on average, the tropical cyclone wind speeds, so now we're just talking like per cyclone individually, that they are on average projected to increase. And that is predominantly due to the warmer sea temperatures, which, yeah, serves as fuel, as I said before. And we also see that the fraction of intense cyclones increases in almost all regions except for the Bay of Bengal. So we're pretty much in line with, well, what you just said.
Will the biggest storms get even bigger, or is there a limit approaching? It sounded from my reading of the paper that sea surface temperatures might be a determining factor, but is there a limit, or can these things just get bigger and bigger?
we're not going to go towards like the Hurricane Heist movie type of situations. No, there is an environmental limit to how strong tropical cyclones can get. And that is a factor, an environmental variable, which is known as the maximum potential intensity. And that maximum potential intensity depends on sea surface temperatures and a couple of more environmental parameters. Because of that environment then kind of limits a tropical cyclone to go on to like infinite intensities. But just to give you an idea, hurricanes Dorian and Irma, they were pretty close to that maximum potential intensity for the North Atlantic Ocean in the climate conditions at that time.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Nadia Blumendahl. We're talking about a study on the upcoming future of storms. Your study does focus on Category 3 storms, but what about the really big ones like the Cat 4 and Cat 5? Will they also increase?
The way that our study works is that, we assess return periods. And a return period, you should basically see that as an exceedance probability. So if we're talking about the return period of a Category 3, we're actually talking about the exceedance probability of Category 3 wind speeds. So anything of Category 3 and up. So we're not just looking at Category 3s. So we're looking at 3, 4, 5. And the reason that we took that Category 3 threshold is because at Category 3 wind speeds, already significant damage starts to occur. And that is the information that you need for your risk assessments.
Tell us what these storm models suggest about the future poleward expansion. Do we know how much further up the east or west coast of North America, for example, such high-intensity hurricanes might go in coming decades?
So I cannot give you an exact distance in terms of kilometers or miles. It still depends very much on the environmental conditions, how far a cyclone can actually travel, like in absolute distance. But what we did find in our study is that in the Western Pacific and in the North Atlantic, the location of maximum intensity, the latitude at which the tropical cyclone reaches its peak intensity, that is shifting poleward. So that means also because of those warmer seawaters, that means that warmer seawater is extending further poleward. So it's supporting the tropical cyclone with higher intensities further poleward. So we are going to see probably intense cyclones traveling further north, but don't ask me exact distances because, I can't give you that.
It kind of surprised me when Hurricane Sandy hit New York and New Jersey. We don't think of New Jersey as a hurricane area. But perhaps in the future, they will get more, and so we'll have to be on our watch for that. You also studied low probability events. Why, when they're so much less likely to happen?
So the reason that we are interested in low probability events is because these are the events that rarely happen, but when they do happen, they inflict a lot of damage. A Category 4 or 5 event in your coastal town in America or wherever you may be, getting a Category 4 or 5 in your city is what we consider a low probability event. It doesn't happen every year, fortunately not. And it's these type of events, as I said, it's these type of events that inflict the most damage. So that is why from a risk perception, we want to understand these low probability events and we want to mitigate the risks of these low probabilities, high impact events.
Well, you mentioned cities, and at least 8% of humans live in megacities, and that's where the really big risk as far as insurers go, and just for people's lives, that's where the biggest damage is. Did you study the future of big storms for cities?
In our paper, we did demonstrate how you can use our storm data sets to study tropical cyclone risk near big cities. We did not show that for every single big city on Earth. I probably would need to have another 3 or 4 papers to discuss just that. But what we did do is we examined it for 18 coastal cities evenly distributed around ocean basins. So we did do that.
Australia is already a stormy place. What lies in the hotter future for our Australian listeners?
The short answer is that the northeast coast of Australia is located in a region that, according to our study, will face a pretty significant increase in that risk for intense tropical cyclones. To give you an idea for Cairns in Australia, we found that intense tropical cyclone conditions used to have a return period of 50 years, so over the time period 1980-2017. But over the time period 2015-2050, this return period changes to around once every 20 years. So going from once every 50 years to once every 20 years, yeah, that's a substantial increase in your risk right there. And you probably also want to know what exactly does this mean in terms of, you know, what should you do with this information? Well, you should see it as such that, yeah, risk mitigation strategies, they are typically built or designed for a certain return period. So for instance, the building code of your house is built such that it withstands a 1-in-100-year wind speed. Your house should be able to withstand a 1-in-100-year wind speed. That is where that return period comes in. Now, if you have a house that is built for that 1-in-100-year wind speed, and then suddenly that 1-in-100-year is the 1-in-40-year wind speed, you need to update your building code because your risk has increased and your house might be able to be damaged sooner than what it was built for. That's what we're talking about here in terms of risk, that for Cairns, for instance, you need to start looking at your risk mitigation strategies and you might need to update them as government, as policymakers, as whoever is involved there.
Well, another way I would look at it, if you talk about a return period of 50 years changing to a return period of 20 years, that really means that a person might expect to see one big storm in their lifetime previously, might see two giant storms now. Would that be a correct interpretation?
That is one way to interpret it, but don't forget that even the 1-in-500-year storm could happen at any given time. Any of those return period storms could happen in any given year. Hurricane Irma also had a return period of around once every 500 years, and it happened 3 years ago. That doesn't mean, or 5 years ago by now, that doesn't mean that it cannot happen next year. Like it has an annual probability of occurrence. So, but yeah, with your annual probability substantially increasing, chances are higher that you are going to experience one of these events in your lifetime.
What does your new study tell us about expected cyclone changes in Hong Kong and the South Pacific?
Yeah, so for Hong Kong, we found that, well, we're going to go back to that discussion on the return periods. So for Hong Kong, we found that intense tropical cyclones used to have a return period of around once every 80 years. And that is going to increase to once every 20 years. So that's a fourfold increase in your probability in the near future compared to, yeah, the last 30 years, which is substantial. And well, for the South Pacific, I already discussed the situation for Cairns in Australia, but also in South Pacific island nations, we see, for instance, in New Caledonia, in Tonga, Fiji, that risk is increasing tremendously. And also more people will be exposed to intense tropical cyclone conditions in these regions.
Talking about flooding and fire, one factor increasing damages and the loss of life is more people are moving to the coast and into the wooded lands. People move into the danger zone. Is it the same with tropical cyclones, do you know?
Yes. That's the very short answer. Yes. So the thing is that more people are migrating towards coastal cities, and also with general population increase and then more people living in these coastal cities, you will see that more people will find themselves in the path of a tropical cyclone in case of an imminent storm. And when more people are exposed and you don't have risk mitigation strategies in place, or yeah, they are outdated in the light of climate change, that means that more people might experience harm or even loss of life. I really hope not. I want to get that straight. But we also might see more damages because people have assets, people have valuable cars and such, and they get damaged by tropical cyclones. So you see more damages occurring then. Now, the study that we did solely focuses on wind speed, but tropical cyclones, of course, also bring storm surge and precipitation when they come onshore. So if you live closer to the ocean and you don't have a dike or a coastal wall and there's a storm surge coming, yeah, then you might find yourself also facing a flood risk. So it's definitely also the case with tropical cyclones that there are more and more people getting in harm's way.
I was looking at figure 5 in your paper, and it looked like we are seeing upward trends of winds in almost every part of the world. Is it fair to say our children will encounter more windy days, including intense winds, than our grandparents did?
Well, I would like to phrase it a little bit differently. Our children are at larger risk of facing these wind speeds, these extreme conditions. And therefore, my generation and the generation that will come after me, our children, it's really, really important that we start working on getting those adaptation measures in place. We need to mitigate that risk so that they are also safe under future warming. And of course, also drastically cutting back emissions, because that is at the heart of this whole climate change problem. Of course, I don't think I need to say that. One minor comment that I would like to make here, it only takes one severe tropical cyclone to change someone's life. It might be that your grandparents lived through, well, the Galveston hurricane is a bit long ago, but, you know, your grandparents might have experienced a very intense cyclone as well, but the chances that your kid is going to experience that in their life is probably larger than for your grandparents.
It's another reason why we really have to avoid extreme climate change for sure. Now, you helped to develop this new tool to help project cyclones or hurricanes. What's next for you?
For me personally, I am currently involved in a project together with Columbia University in New York, where we work on, you know, further improving our understanding of this tropical cyclone risk and how this is going to change under climate change. We are looking at various climate scenarios, so not just the SSP 585, which I used in this study, but also other emission scenarios, other time periods. And we are hoping to better understand how these different emission scenarios, what effect that has on risk. So that is what I am doing currently now. And if we're talking about, okay, you know, let's take this 10 years from now, where do I want to see this go? Yeah, I really hope that in 10 years from now, I'll be in an active position informing governments and policymakers on, you know, the risk that they are facing on tropical cyclones, but maybe also other natural hazards. My interest is wider than just the tropical cyclone, to help them better understand their risk and implement risk mitigation strategies so that, you know, we can save more people and hopefully reduce damages in the future in the light of climate change.
I could see a future where a climate advisor is a cabinet position in government.
Yeah, I will be very much up for that. Maybe not in the Netherlands, though, because we don't really have tropical cyclones here, but hey, you never know.
I really appreciated the tool that you developed. It took me a while to work through, and then I realized, yeah, this is a really good thing to have. And I didn't realize there was such a hole in the big global climate models until I read your paper.
Yeah, So it's, you know, just to give you a little bit more perspective, you also mentioned Kerry Emanuel in one of your questions. So he built one of these global synthetic models. Columbia University built a synthetic model, and then my model is the third global one. So there are not a lot of them out there right now that are, you know, embedded in academia. Of course, catastrophe modeling companies, they have their own tools, but they are also usually working with, you know, whichever portfolio is interesting. So they, yeah, you know, they also tend to leave out developing countries or, you know, these small island nations that I mentioned in, for instance, the Pacific. So, yeah, you know, like building the tool that I did and now, couple of years in understanding what exactly it is that we can all do with it. Like it's just, it's so great. It's so, it opens so many possibilities to better understand that risk. And we're now the first ones to publish that for climate change at a very high local scale, basically. And when you ask, like, now what? Another answer that I could have given is, I just really hope that there will be more of these type of models in the future, because, well, I think you know that not one model is the absolute truth, but if you have a whole lot of models, then the truth is somewhere in there. Like, they converge to the truth. They reach a consensus, and that is what we need. So I hope that my study will also, you know, spark interest with other researchers to dive into this and do a bit more on it.
From Free University Amsterdam, we have been speaking with Research Associate Nadia Bloemendaal, and you can find links to all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. And Nadia, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Isn't it wonderful how nature evolved to support us? Except that isn't how it works at all. A lifetime leader in conservation warns, planet Earth is not a delicately balanced, benign being. Robert Nassy should know. Dr. Nassy is a French-trained ecologist, now director general of the world's largest forest science organization, C4. We will find out what that is and the changing role of tropical forests, especially here on a climate-challenged planet. From Bogor, Indonesia, Robert Nassy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good morning, Alex. Thank you for having me.
You lead a global conservation group with a multi-million-dollar budget. You are an acknowledged expert on tropical forest life. What stirred you to poke around at this image of well-meaning nature?
Talk about what we are having here is an international research organization that has a mandate to work on forest trees and agroforestry, mostly in the tropics. And we are looking at the contribution on forest trees and agroforestry to the sustainable development, livelihood of the people, preservation of the environment, and crises like the biodiversity loss or climate crisis or inequality, inequities. What we are facing and have been in this line of quote-unquote business for almost 40 years now, you sometimes wake up with the feeling that we didn't make much progress. And what you read is this sort of idea that human beings are particularly important in the grand scheme of things, and that if we don't do anything, the world will disappear, and that we need to rebalance our relationship with Mother Earth or something like that. And I think that's very much a hubris thing. I mean, we don't really count in the grand scheme of things. I mean, a sort of humans are a blip in the history of Earth, whether we disappear or not because of our foolishness, Earth will continue, life will continue in a different way. And so that's why I wanted to write this piece. And I don't know, I think that if we do something now, it's not for Mother Earth, it's for us, because Mother Earth doesn't really care about us. So, and I know that some people may disagree, but I don't think that nature is a benign being. I mean, a sort of if a species disappeared, and we have had 5 recorded mass extinctions in the past, some of these have lost more than 95% of the existing life form at that time. And humans, we are starting the 6th mass extinction, and we may end up being part of the list of the one going extinct. That's why, I mean, you need to wake up the people and say, guys, we need to do something. Is for us, primarily, if we want to continue having a civilization and enjoying the beauty on Earth.
I want to get to a key sentence that you wrote in your blog post at the C4 site. You said, tipping points are rapid, brutal changes in socio-ecological systems triggered by slow variables. Now, there's a whole lot in that sentence, and I think everybody needs to understand this key thought. How would you unpack that?
The easiest example is the classical one is what you call the eutrophication of lake. That means that you have a lake in a place, and this lake is full of fish, and the water of the lake are more or less neutral in terms of acidity, and there is light, and so there is an ecosystem functioning. And then you have this lake is surrounded by agricultural land, and these agricultural land are slowly seeping nitrogen for the fertilizer in the lake. And for a long time, you don't see anything. And then one morning, you wake up, the lake is different. Suddenly, it's brown. Most of the fish are floating belly up because they are dead. And then you have passed the tipping point. So the slow variable was the sort of the slow building of the nitrogen in the water. And then when it reached a certain level, then the lake flipped into another state. The tipping points were local. So you had a lake that was trophic, or you had an ecosystem, a forest that had moved into a savanna because of degradation. What is happening now is that we are seeing emergence of global tipping points, and that's a big problem. Like people forecast that the Amazon will become a savanna within the next 20 or 30 years, and that will be irreversible. And if we lose the Amazon forest, we lose a huge amount of carbon sequestration and all the water regime, the rainfall that is linked with that. So it will become overnight something that is a big issue. And other of these tipping points are the melting of the polar caps or the changing direction of the Gulf Stream or the oceanic currents, or the thawing of the permafrost. That thing that will suddenly shift in another state and at the global scale and create havoc. And the additional problem we have is that there's about 10, 12 of these global tipping points, and they are interrelated. That means that when you triggered one, you will end up having a cascade effect, and then other will be triggered. So that's the melting of the polar cap will change the direction of the Gulf Stream, that will change the temperature and the rainfall in the Amazon, that will convert the Amazon in the savanna. And that's what we have managed to do with our activity. We have totally...
You know, we hear a lot about the Amazon rainforest. Let's talk for a minute about Indonesia, where you are based. How would you compare the importance of the great forests of Indonesia and the Amazon?
They are as important. I mean, I don't think that you can give a sort of value judgment. One is more important than the other. The fact is that as of today, we haven't seen a tipping point like that in the Indonesian forest, because they are spread on a very different gradient of ecological condition, high land, low land, several islands. What we have noticed, nevertheless, is the fact that there has been a steady decrease in precipitation over Borneo, for example. And that may be something that is the first premise of a potential tipping point, right? Because when the precipitation will become too low, I mean, forests will not be able to exist and will move into a more open vegetation. So I don't think that one is more important than the other. I think both are important. The one that is, in a sense, in the news now because there is empirical evidence that something is happening is the Amazon.
You know, there was sort of a major climate event in late 1997-98, that strong El Nino year, and Indonesian peat bogs that had been drained for palm oil plantations caught fire, and that deep peat released so much carbon dioxide that Indonesia, which is a developing country, rose to be one of the three biggest greenhouse gas emitters on the planet that year, and there was a lot of unhealthy smoke. I worry that can happen again, and perhaps that is... We won't call it a tipping point, but it is a major climate event, I think.
Yeah, it is a major event, and then unfortunately, it happened more than 97. There was a big fire in 2015 or so, and then 2019, related to similar issue. The fact is that this peatland, they cover about 3% of the surface of the world, but they store as much carbon as all the other vegetation combined. And so when they are going in smoke, they release a lot of greenhouse gases. And that's why, I mean, the government of Indonesia, following the 2015 fire, realized that it was urgent to restore this peatland where they have been degraded, and they have created a specific agency to do that, and they are embarking in a program of restoration of peatland. It's not an easy feat, but it's a positive movement. And then we see the same also in temperate or boreal peatland, where people realize, oh, we better not touch this ecosystem and try to restore the one that we have degraded, because they are potentially, on an area basis, the most dangerous emitter of greenhouse gases.
One last thing on Indonesia specifically. I know that the two biggest pulp and paper companies in the country, APP and April, they're both planning massive expansion of production. I think they're going to double it or something. And I worry this will lead to conversion of more of Indonesia's remaining intact forest, maybe in West Papua or Kalimantan. What would be your thoughts on that?
It's a bit difficult to have a sort of a definite, informed opinion on that. If you listen to the proponent, APP or RAPP, they will tell you that, in fact, they plan to feed their mill with their existing plantation. And that may be possible. So that means that there will not be more opening or more cutting of natural forest for plantation. And legislation in Indonesia these days has a permanent moratorium on cutting any primary forest or any new concession on peatland. So there is some sort of safeguard, but nothing is really said about secondary forest. So it's a matter of how this company will be conscious, control. There is something that can be played by government in terms of legislation, but also by consumers in terms of not buying paper for a company that is cutting primary forest to make pulp and paper. The jury is still out on this one.
In the 1980s and 90s, I recall, and this was before there was a climate movement, saving forests was a focus of environmental activism. We wanted to save this valley or that valley. Hundreds were arrested here in Canada. Do forest activists now have to introduce themselves as climate players just to be relevant?
No, but for a long time, I mean, it's probably starting with, let's say, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. There has been an environmental movement, and this environmental movement has generally been opposed to logging or to cutting forests or any human activity that degrades the environment. For a long time, I mean, these people have been considered as marginal, and the interests of industry and corporation were considered more important and we cut forest. And what is happening with the climate agenda is that suddenly forest got a much more prominent public profile, because they were large repository of sequestered carbon, and also they were offering some relatively cheap opportunity to store more carbon if you plant more trees. And so that's why suddenly forestry and sustainable forestry was surfing on the wave of climate change mitigation or adaptation. It's a positive point in a sense for the forest. It's not a good sign, because we have not managed to solve it for the last 40 years.
Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.
We are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Robert Nassy, Director General of the Center for International Forestry Research, CIFOR. We're talking about forests, climate change, and human change. Okay, Robert, you lead the CIFOR group, and that now includes another organization called World Agroforestry. I will bet most of my listeners do not know what these are, because really you're dealing with governments and large nonprofits and banks, but not so much with the public face, as I've noticed. What do you do as an organization, Robert?
CIFOR and ICRAF, the World Agroforestry Center, I mean, are international organizations that do research, capacity development, and communication outreach on the issue of forest, trees, and agroforestry. And so what do? We work with many partners. And just to give you an idea, I mean, CIFOR and ICRAF is about 700 people. Half of these people are scientists and do research, and we are operating in about 90 countries, and we have a permanent presence in 30 other countries. So it's not a big organization if you compare to other organizations like the UN or FAO. But I think we have a meaningful and significant influence on the agenda on forestry and agroforestry. And then we are working with partners because we are too small to do things by ourselves. And because if you want to achieve results, you need to have a partner in country and that are believing in the same thing as you, and they are willing to do the same thing. And we have five thematic area. One is climate change. The other one is about value chain, finance and investment. One on governance, gender equality. One in soil health, land health. One on genetic resources and biodiversity. And we have a team of scientists that are working on the ground with partners in terms of answering the question that are asked by policymakers or by communities for the sustainable management of forestry and agroforestry. Of course, like many science organizations, we are not necessarily very good at communicating to the large public, but that's something that we realized a few years ago, and we have significant communication program, use of social media, and so it's getting better, but I guess that, yes, a lot of your audience doesn't know who we are. But if you go to our website, I mean, I think it's in open access, and you can learn very, very quickly.
And that's at c4.org. I am a bit nervous about defining forests as tools for human use. What does the term agroforestry really mean, and can it be truly green?
There is a definition on forest. I mean, generally speaking, by FAO or by the Convention on Climate Change. But since I've been working, forester, I've been always discussing about the definition of forest. And my best definition on forest is that when you are inside the forest, you know that it is a forest. And you don't necessarily need to know what the percentage of canopy cover. And agroforestry is something that it's a form of management, and it's where you introduce trees into agricultural land to create a more complex and more diverse and more resilient system. You can have a rice field totally devoid of tree, or you can have a rice field growing trees together with the rice field. These trees produce fodder for your livestock or fruits for the village or shade or whatever. So they produce additional service that comes on top of your agricultural production, and because of the way they have been installed, they do not have a negative impact on the main commodity that you want to produce, be it maize or rice or cocoa or coffee. So that's the idea of the agroforestry system, sort of putting more trees in agricultural land. And although the term was into the Western countries, farmers in Indonesia have been, and in many other places, have been using agroforestry system for millennia. Well, in home garden, there is a very long history of man in terms of using agroforestry system, and probably longer than there is a history of doing monoculture. When you had the hedgerow in the field, in Europe or in the temperate country, that has an agroforestry system. I mean, unfortunately, because of the way our economic system is working, people have had a tendency to drop this agroforestry system and to move to more intensive monoculture with higher fertilizer input, and so that produce more on an hectare basis, but on the longer term create a lot of environmental problem. And that's why we have this problem now with agriculture and food system that are the main cause of deforestation, but also one of the main cause of unsustainable land use or loss of fertility and so on.
Here is something else we all need to learn about. What is the Global Landscapes Forum, and what is your role in that?
The Global Landscape Forum is a partnership platform with now I think about 30 or 35 members, and it is really the place to exchange and the place to bring together people that will not talk to each other normally. So it brings together not only the forest people, but also the agricultural people and the people interested in fresh water, the people interested in blue carbon in ocean. So that, and you create this platform where the vice president of the World Bank can discuss with a group of farmers in one place. And all this, it's very important because a lot of the reason why we are not managing particularly well landscape is the fact that there is not enough communication, not enough exchange between the different players. And so that was the idea of when we created the Global Landscape Forum. That was a sort of an offspring of some event that we were organizing was Forest Day and Agricultural Day, putting together. And now it becomes one of the largest platform, and we have reached more than 250 million people through social media. When we organize events, we have more than 140, 150 countries, nationality participating to the events. For something like the Global Landscape Forum, the COVID-19 has been somewhat of a blessing in disguise, because as it was not possible to travel, we move into a more digital sort of event, and then suddenly you can have people that will not have the money to travel to attend your big conference, but now could participate through online platform and we could reach more people. So that's the whole idea, is sort of create a movement around the sustainable management of landscape. And by landscape, we mean large territories where there are several conflicting or use like agriculture, forestry, urbanization, industry.
You talk about the need to move from fossil power to a bio-based economy. How do you envision an economy based on biology rather than oil, coal, and gas? And can we do it without killing off more natural systems?
If we want to have a chance to stay under the 2-degree limit in terms of climate change, we need to reduce considerably or even stop our fossil fuel consumption by 2050. Because I don't think that people will want to go back to walking, using horses, or we will need to find a substitute. And this substitute could be renewable energy using wind, using hydropower, using solar. But some of the biggest greenhouse gas emissions are in terms of making concrete, making cement, steel. And so we could also use wood material, wood-derived material, to replace concrete and steel. But that means that we need to still have a significant amount of forest or a significant amount of plantation that produce this wood material. And that's a real challenge, because if we want to move into a bio-based economy, we need more forest, we need more plantation, and we need to have that at the same time without jeopardizing the need to feed the people and to have land for agriculture. So that's a big challenge, but it's a challenge that I think we can face. But we need to start now because it takes time for trees to grow. And you see more and more, in fact, appearing. Some people are building skyscraper with cross-laminated timber. And there is also the same with using biomass to produce energy, which may be topical, but in some condition maybe something quite logical and something that will avoid using fossil fuel. So that's the whole idea. I mean, so if we want to continue having a decent standard of living and reduce our fossil fuel consumption, we need to find alternatives. And we do have some alternatives in terms of energy, but in terms of building material, in terms of clothes, and we need to find other alternatives. And the best alternative we have are derived from wood.
Is there an overarching plan to use world forests to help stabilize the climate or at least slow down our damage?
We cannot stabilize the climate only using forests and trees. That's not going to work. The only way we can stabilize the climate is to stop emitting greenhouse gases and to start capturing some of the CO2 that is already emitted. Forests can certainly play a role in that, forests and trees. But if you consider that about 30% of the emission of green gases come from the forest and land use sector, that means that 70% comes from somewhere else. So that's, unless we fix the somewhere else, and this is the whole issue of using use of fossil fuel or very green carbon intensive industry like steel making or cement making, we are not going to solve our problem. So forest, definitely part of a solution, but not the solution. We need a combination of less dependency to fossil fuel, more renewable energy, more use of biomaterial and more forest. The advantage that we have in terms of forest is that when you have completely decarbonized a sector, there is a residual amount of fossil fuel that you will still need to use. And then you can think of that for airline travel or for shipping. I mean, it will be very difficult to decarbonize completely this sector. Then you can use additional forest or additional tree planting to offset these remaining greenhouse gases that you cannot remove from your industrial sector. So forest and trees and agroforestry system and for the matter ocean and seagrass and have a role to play in terms of combating climate crisis, but they cannot be the only solution.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I think that in spite of all the gloom and doom, we should remain optimistic. And then we should try to solve our problem and certainly not running into the street with the cover in ashes and setting the doom day. And I think we can do it. But that requires that everybody act and not simply look at what the other is doing. And it's a matter of government, it's a matter of individual choices, but it's also very much a society matter. So I think we can do it if we want. We don't have a lot of time to do it, but it's now or never. And as I said at the beginning, I mean, a sort of whether we do it and we thrive as a new ecological civilization, or we don't do it and we disappear, Mother Earth wouldn't care much.
From Bogor, Indonesia, we have been speaking with Dr. Robert Nasi, scientist and director general of the Center for International Forestry Research. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and you can go direct to www.c4.org. Robert, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That is all the time we have for Radio EcoShock this week. Don't forget, if you disagree with something you heard, or you want to build it up with more tips and links, post a comment in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. I delay the post slightly to filter out the bots, but your comment will appear. We are getting a good flow of guests in right now, but I always value tips from listeners. Send your ideas and feedback by email. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Your time is valuable. Thank you for listening and caring about this world.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Yanis Varoufakis on looming threats in the global economy and the war in Ukraine. Yanis Varoufakis taught economics in Britain, Australia, and his hometown of Athens, Greece. In 2015, he became part of the Greek government. After his resignation, he remained deeply involved in European politics. This is an interview by Steve Paikin on Canadian Public TV on April 21st, 2022. Paikin is host of TVO's public affairs program, The Agenda and a well-known documentary producer. Here is his introduction of Yanis Varoufakis.
We are living in turbulent economic times with war in Eastern Europe, a global pandemic disrupting supply chains, and inflation rising sharply. Economist Yanis Varoufakis took a turn as Greece's Minister of Finance, founded the new political party Meta 25, and has become a vocal critic of how the global economy was put back together after the Great Recession almost 15 years ago. What does he now see on the horizon amid the period of turmoil we're now encountering? Let's find out as Yanis Varoufakis joins us now from Athens, Greece. Good to see you again. How are you managing these days?
Personally, all things considered, I'm very well in a very turbulent world. It's very good to see you again, Steve.
Thank you for saying so. Let me start with the worst story in the world today, namely what's happening between Russia and Ukraine. Do you believe the sanctions that many Western countries have put on Russia are working?
Yes and no. They're working in the sense that they are damaging majestically the Russian economy. The Russian people are suffering and will continue increasingly to suffer from them. There may be a loss of national income in Russia of up to 20%, disproportionately affecting the many. Do I think they will be working regarding the capacity of Mr. Putin to persecute the war? Absolutely not. Already we have seen that Russia's balance of payments are in a huge surplus of $250 billion because, this is no mystery, when you stop importing due to sanctions, but you continue to export gas and oil, including to the European Union, you know, we send $700 million every day from the European Union to Mr. Putin, you end up with a huge surplus. And that surplus is allowing Mr. Putin to run his government without any hitch financially, accounting-wise. And let's also face it, he's a dictator. He doesn't care about his people. So, no, they're not working. If by working you mean impeding his capacity to persecute the war or his will to do so.
In which case do you think we should tighten the screws even further?
Well, I don't believe we can, because I think that President Biden has used the nuclear option. And the nuclear option when it comes to sanctions is the cutting off of the Central Bank of Russia from the international dollarized payment system. Yes, Europe could cease and desist from purchasing natural gas, especially Germany, from the pipeline going under the name of Nord Stream 1. But, you know, that would reduce the flow of dollars into the Russian state coffers. But he would find a way, Putin that is, of channeling this energy to other countries, to India, to China. So I don't believe that more sanctions are going to slow down the death rate and, you know, the crimes against humanity carried out in Ukraine. I believe that it is absolutely morally pertinent for us to try to find ways of effecting an immediate ceasefire and a withdrawal of the Russian troops, which I'm afraid will involve a kind of negotiation with Mr. Putin that no one would want to have, but everybody must find a way of persecuting.
No, I appreciate that. You can't make peace with your friends. You got to make peace with your enemies, and that often means having unpleasant conversations, but to date, he hasn't shown any interest that I can see that he's interested in having negotiations the likes of which you just described. So what do we do?
Well, there are ongoing negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. They're not getting anywhere. And I believe that, I always believe that from day one, from the 24th of February, that none of these negotiations can ever get us anywhere because you cannot have an effective binding agreement between somebody like President Zelensky, who is the president of the country that has been invaded and therefore the weak link in this negotiation, and some autocrat like Putin on the other. The negotiation that must happen is one between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin. Putin needs to be given a way out not because we want to give him a way out. I would very much like to see him, get his comeuppance. But if we want to end this conflict now, there has to be a negotiation between Washington and Moscow. This has not happened. Every time I hear Joe Biden talk about genocide or dragging Putin through a criminal court, what I see is a signal coming from Washington that there will be no negotiation. And I don't believe that Washington has the ethical right to sacrifice the Ukrainians on behalf of some moral drive to see Putin come down, because Putin will not come down. He's not going to be brought down in less than 5, 6, 7, 8 years by a combination of sanctions and more of a war of attrition. And I don't think we have the right to inflict upon Ukrainians another 5, 6 years of this. We do not have the right to turn Ukraine into an Afghanistan in the European Union's periphery. Because even though some people say to me, but look, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the end defeated the Soviets. Yes, but look at Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It's a cesspit of malignancy. In the end, it's an ungovernable and destroyed place. We do not want this for the Ukraine.
Well, let me ask you about the post-Cold War world, because, of course, 30-plus years ago, I guess the prevailing wisdom was, if we have added economic integration between the West and Russia, then surely that will keep the peace, because, after all, nobody wants to invade a country that you're doing business with. Clearly, that theory has fallen apart. Do you think it was a mistake in hindsight to be so dependent on Russian fossil fuels?
I do not believe, Steve, that the theory has fallen apart. If anything, with the benefit of hindsight, the West should be self-critical and understand that it never gave that theory a chance. Let me remind you that after 1991, Russia was on its knees. You had Yeltsin, you had in the prime ministership of Russia and in the government of Russia, liberal reformists. Why were they crushed? They were crushed because the International Monetary Fund and Washington insisted on a policy of exacting a pound of flesh from the Russian economy in the form of debt repayments that the Russian economy was simply not prepared to make. Let me remind you that between 1995 and 1998, Russia was pushed into a major financial crisis by the West. The IMF brought Russia to its knees in 1998. Let me remind you that because of this policy by the International Monetary Fund in Washington, the life expectancy of men in Russia fell from 78 to 56 years of age. This has never happened in any country in the world in such a short space of time to have this crushing effect on an economy, a society. It is my considered opinion that the monster that goes by the name Vladimir Putin was bred in the guts of this gigantic humiliation of the Russian people, that was affected by the denial to the Russian people of the opportunity to join the global economy. So it is time that Washington takes a very good look at itself in the mirror and understand that it's not that integrating the Russian economy didn't work. It was the choice of Washington, and in particular the International Monetary Fund, in association with Washington, D.C., it was the choice not to integrate Russia that gave rise to Putin, the oligarchs, and gave the impetus to a process by which Russia became the villain of the piece.
Is it also fair to say, though, that because countries like Germany are so dependent on Russian oil and gas to keep the lights on, that in effect, the West is in a perverse way funding some of this war?
True, entirely. But it's a combination of the two things, what you say and what I say. On the one hand, you crush a society like Russia, a proud people like the Russians. You crush them. The West crushed them. Remember, Putin, when he first became president, even suggested that Russia joins NATO. And he was turned away. And his economy was crushed. So a combination of humiliating them, humiliating a nuclear power, Not a very clever thing to do, while at the same time relying on them, as you said quite correctly, for gas and oil. This is a policy made in hell. It's a policy that whoever has devised it needs to have their head examined collectively.
All right, let me set up my next set of questions by reading this excerpt from something Patty Hirsch did on The Indicator by Planet Money. This is an NPR podcast, and it goes like this. Some observers are saying that Russia has essentially created a Potemkin currency. This is a reference to Grigory Potemkin, who was appointed governor of Crimea after Catherine the Great annexed it in 1784. Eager to show Catherine how successful he had been in resettling Crimea with Russian villagers, Potemkin supposedly built and populated a mobile village that he assembled, disassembled, and then reassembled along her route as she inspected the region. The head of the Central Bank of Russia, Elvira Nebulina, is essentially playing Potemkin to Putin's Catherine, using a range of tools to make the ruble look like a currency that has value, when in fact very few people outside Russia want to buy a single ruble unless they absolutely have to, and when many people inside Russia don't really want rubles either. Okay, what are the range of tools that the central bank has used to prop up the currency during the course of this war? Help us understand that.
While I'm loath to be critical of NPR, because I like NPR, it's one of the few sources of news from the United States, I have to say that what you just read out is a very good example of terrible economic thinking. There is no Potemkin village in the Russian ruble, and proof of that is that since that piece was written on NPR.org, the ruble has risen. And has risen on the back of very fundamental magnitudes. As I said before, the surplus of the balance of payments of the Russian Republic has risen to $250 billion. Now, a currency reflects, the value of the currency reflects whether it's the country's balance of payments is in surplus or in deficit, and to what extent it is in surplus or in deficit. By curtailing imports due to sanctions and massively boosting the revenues of the Russian state from oil and gas, because even if they are selling less oil and gas, the crisis in the energy market has boosted the price of oil and gas to such an extent that their revenues are actually skyrocketing at a time when expenditure on imports has collapsed. So the ruble is backed by fundamentals. This is not a Potemkin ruble. It's the reality of a combination of capital controls, of imports that are diminishing, and of exports whose dollar value is increasing massively.
All right, let's focus on Ukraine. And I mean, this is a shocking number to report, but apparently the Ukrainian economy is going to contract by as much as 40% by the end of the year. The IMF has just said that the international economy is also going to deteriorate significantly because of this war. You have a huge understanding of a contracting economy from your time as the Minister of Finance in Greece. What advice would you give to the Ukrainian finance minister right now?
Sue for peace. We need to end the destruction. Look, GDP numbers do not matter at all when people are dying. When you see a bridge destroyed, what matters is who was on the bridge and who died and who was maimed. The bridge itself doesn't matter, because once peace has been achieved, rebuilding it is going to boost GDP faster than its destruction diminishes. By the way, you mentioned the IMF. I have a message for my good friends in Washington, D.C. at the International Monetary Fund. Put your money where your mouth is. If you really care about Ukraine, stop extracting, as we speak, billions of dollars in interest payments from Ukraine's public debt, debt to the IMF. The IMF should restructure, should haircut, should write down the debt of Ukraine instead of insisting of exacting pounds of flesh from the state of Ukraine while the people of Ukraine are struggling to survive. So let's end this hypocrisy. Let's end the war And let's have the international community, and in particular the European Union, pour billions of euros, of dollars, of yen, whatever, you know, Canadian dollars, into reconstructing the Ukraine.
Is it even possible to recreate any semblance of consumer confidence or tackle inflation if the war continues?
Well, the war is making a bad thing worse. Remember, inflation had returned as a result of the interruption of supply chains during the pandemic at the end of the first lockdown. When we were beginning to imagine or to see the light at the end of the tunnel, of the inflationary tunnel, then the Ukrainian war came and turbocharged what was a pre-existing problem. And before that, let me remind you, since 2008, we've been having a crisis of what I call the great deflation, a great deflationary process whereby financial markets, stock exchanges were doing fabulously because of all the money printing by central banks, but austerity was being imposed upon almost every peoples around the West, North America, the European Union, elsewhere. So this combination of effectively socialism for the bankers and the financial sector and austerity for everybody else was squeezing investment in good quality jobs, in the green transition, in green energy, while at the same time creating fabulous riches for the paper pushers in Wall Street and elsewhere. That was the situation before inflation hit us. Then inflation hit us with the pandemic. It was exacerbated by the Ukrainian war. And now we have the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of Canada, the Central Bank of Europe, the Bank of England, and so on, in despair, because over the last 13 years, they have, they've been keeping the corporate world addicted to cheap finance. So you have the whole of the corporate world of the North Atlantic utterly dependent on the printing presses of our central banks. And now these printing presses have absolutely no answer to the question, how do you maintain a semblance of normality in the corporate sector while pushing inflation down? And the war in Ukraine is preventing even a sensible discussion on how this is going to happen. So the war in Ukraine must end today. It must end because Ukrainians are dying and because more war is not the answer to war. And it must end because the poor all over the world, not just, of course, in Europe and North America, but across the world with inflation when it comes to food prices in Africa, in Asia, in India, destroying the lives of countless millions of people. So we have a moral duty to end this war.
We have something here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, called the Hot Docs Film Festival. And you are the subject of a very significant documentary. It's 4 hours long, actually, about your political life. It's called In the Eye of the Storm, The Political Odyssey of Yiannis Varoufakis.
Death is to capitalism that which hell is to Christianity. Unpleasant and essential. Whereas death was tangential to life before capitalism, with capitalism it becomes the turbocharging unit of production. It's what allowed immense productive resources and capacities and forces to be unleashed by capitalism, the result being the modern world that we live in.
That is a great metaphor about debt. And okay, we understand the unpleasant part about debt, but the essential part of debt, what is that?
Before capitalism, you had production, you know, peasants were working on the land and they would produce, the harvest would come in and the lord would send the sheriff to take the lord's cut, to put it simply. And then the lord would sell that cut in open markets and near the villages and so on. And that would create financialization, that would give some money to the lord and the lord would then lend it on to other people. So debt would come at the very end of the line of production and distribution. But with capitalism, what you have is entrepreneurs borrowing in advance, before production begins, to lease land, to lease machines, to pay workers, before any production was, happened. The order was reversed. Debt came first, then came distribution, you know, this is how much the workers will take, this is how much the banks will take, this is how much the lumbers will take, and then came production at the end. That reversal of this order with debt fueling production unleashed tremendous powers in the world economy and shaped the modern world. But at the same time, what it did, because it was a good thing, too much of a good thing, allows the ones who controlled it, in other words, the bankers, to enrich themselves fabulously and to grow more and more of it. In a sense, humanity under capitalism is borrowing from the future, hoping to be able to repay the future. At some point, when this becomes very profitable, we keep borrowing too much from the future. And then the present cannot repay the future. And then you have a collapse, like we had in 2008, a major event in human history, akin to what happened in 1929. And I do believe that we're still in the same crisis. The one you and I were talking about in 2010, 2011, it has never gone away, really. The war in Ukraine is escalating one of the guises of that crisis that began in 2008. And I'm sure economic historians in the future are going to describe as our generation's 1929.
Hmm.
And one of the great fallacies that has been adversely affecting the life of common folk out there is the fallacy of looking and concentrating exclusively on public debt and not looking at private debt. Let me remind our viewers that 2008 was a catastrophe caused not by the federal government in the United States, the federal government in Canada, by the governments of the European Union. It was caused by banks. Banks had gone onto a lending, borrowing, and gambling spree. So it was private debt that exploded in 2008, destroying so many lives and putting us in a never-ending crisis. Now, of course, a private debt crisis can very easily morph into a public debt crisis because when the state has to bail out the banks, like it happened, for instance, in Ireland, in Spain, in the United States, for that matter, in the United Kingdom, then suddenly you have a problem of public debt. But the public debt was simply the morphing of the private debt. So we need to look at the debt in total, private and public, and to ask ourselves a question. Is it sustainable? That is this debt or a substantial portion of it going into investment into the things that humanity needs? Unfortunately, since 2008, the answer is a big neon light lit no. If you look at the way we have wasted trillions and trillions of US dollars of printed money, money that did not go into the green energy which we need and which would have decoupled us from Vladimir Putin's Gazprom, just as an example, or indeed from the very dirty energy produced by Canada, by the United States through fracking and so on. We would have had all the green energy we needed had we invested over the last 13, 14 years, even a fraction of the amount of money that was borrowed or printed by central banks. This is the issue. Is the debt turning into investments, into things that we need, not things we don't need, but things we need?
All right, let me return to the documentary for a moment, because you tell another very good story in the documentary about an encounter with Larry Summers, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, in which he basically describes two different kinds of politicians, insiders and outsiders. And you clearly saw yourself as an outsider, but I wonder if, at looking back at all of your time in public life, whether had you been an insider, you may have been able to achieve more. What do you think?
Oh, certainly not. I would have achieved more for my own personal career and enrichment. There's no doubt about that. I was ejected from the corridors of power 6 months after I became finance minister because I wasn't going to sign on the dotted line of things that would have made a bad thing worse for the people of Greece, but also for the people of Europe. What I was told by various high-ranking officials, Larry Summers was not the only one. Christine Lagarde was even more poignant in what she said to me. She said to me that, you know, if I care about my credibility with the insiders, then even though I'm right, I should sign on the dotted line. And I said, I don't care about my credibility. I care about making a difference to the people out there. Had I signed on the dotted line, yes, I would have remained an insider. Could I have made a big difference, a significant difference, by having stayed on the inside? No, because the moment you sign on the dotted line, you simply become an apparatchik, and you simply continue the same policies that deplete the capacity of humanity to create a viable economy, a viable ecology.
I should ask you whether you've actually seen the documentary about your life. It's 4 hours long, as we suggested. Have you seen the whole thing?
I have to say that I have seen it. Look, if you had asked me the first time we met, I remember, in your studio, whether there would ever be a documentary like that, or whether there should be a documentary like that about me, I would have said, it must be crazy. I mean, why should anyone, a cinematographer of the caliber of Raul Martinez, want to do a documentary of me? This is not about me. The reason why I watched it and I helped Raul Martinez produce it, I'm an accidental participant in a broader drama. You would never have heard of me had Europe, the European Union, our countries, my country, not gone bankrupt following the Wall Street collapse. And it so happened that because I didn't sign up on the dotted line, because I didn't become an insider, some people, good people like Raul Martinez, were interested in the story I have to tell, which I think is a universal story. It's not my story. It's a story of how capitalism went belly up in 2008, and how since then central banks and governments have been trying to bail out the financial sector at the expense of the rest of society in a manner which depletes our capacity to create good quality jobs and to invest in averting the climate catastrophe.
That was Yanis Varoufakis on the looming threats in the global economy and the war in Ukraine. He was interviewed by Steve Paikin on Canadian Public TV on April 21st, 2022. Paikin also brought up the four-hour documentary about Varoufakis, just released in May 22 under the title In the Eye of the Storm. The filmmaker Raul Martinez says, in this documentary, Varoufakis raises urgent questions about where our civilization is headed, and he connects economic failure, globalization, democracy, fascism, and the climate crisis. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.